Thank you. If you could just take your seats. Thank you very much. Now, before we have our next speaker, Yvonne Gailey, I just wanted to answer questions which have been raised with Alex Spencer and others about how you can read the texts or get access to these two excellent presentations we had this morning, and indeed all the other ones that you had yesterday. Now, there are four ways in which you can read or gain access to these. Firstly, there will be PDF copies of the texts of the talks on the SASO website. So you just type in SASO to Google and you'll get probably the South African Sports Organization or something. But if you keep trying, it's usually fairly well up the list. The second place you can find it is the PowerPoint presentations, which you've seen this morning, will also be put on the website. And this is a real advance for us. There is an MP3 format of the sound recording of the talks, which has been made as our proceedings are in process, and that will go on the website. And then finally, the old-fashioned technology, the SASO journal, we hope it will contain the text of the papers presented. So I agree with all of you. It's a shame that you can't, these wonderful talks, you can't sort of ponder over them and read them carefully again. And these are the four ways in which we're going to make that possible. Now, if we can move to the next presentation, after two outstanding lectures on risk in general and the position in England and Wales, we now turn to Scotland, which has taken its own approach in this very difficult issue of serious, violent and sexual offenders. And following the committee which sat under Lord Maclean, it introduced a new form of sentence, the Order for Lifelong Restriction, and it also set up the Risk Management Authority. And the next speaker is ideally placed to tell us how all this is working. Yvonne Gailey is the Chief Executive of the Risk Management Authority, and she's worked in it since 2006. So in her talk, Scotland's Approach to Serious, Violent and Sexual Offenders, Early Lessons, she will be able to tell us how Scotland's approach to this has worked, and I think this will be fascinating. And then after her talk, there will be a panel session of about half an hour when all our three speakers for this morning will be sitting up here, and you'll be able to put questions to them on this outstanding range of presentations. So if we could ask Yvonne Gailey to speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you for asking me to be here today. I start with a confession that I have, as you'll see already, somewhat broadened the scope of my presentation. When Alec asked me to come along, it seemed to me natural that I focused on the Order for Lifelong Restriction and Scotland's approach to those few but very serious offenders. But as I pondered on the title, the subtitles of the conference, I thought, I hope it's all right, Ali, I might just broaden it out a little bit and think about Scotland's approach more generally. And I will, however, pay a substantial amount of time looking also at the Order for Lifelong Restriction. And having heard the discussions already this morning, I think I'm quite kind of glad that I did take this approach, because I think we are looking at issues wider than simply managing those very, very few serious offenders. So what first struck me when I was thinking about this presentation, looking at the title and the subtitle of the conference event, was in fact the two words that are repeated several times, which is, can we? Can we manage risk? And my kind of subtitle to that would be, can we manage risk? Can we acknowledge the uncertainty that David's spoken about? Can we be clear about the fact that we will not eliminate risk, and yet use our best endeavours to protect others while promoting human rights, individual worth and dignity? The second part of the title of the conference is about reintegration. So can we support in and reintegrate into the community those people that we currently repeatedly return to prison? Can we actually deliver the credible and demonstrably effective community disposals that the Prisons Commission believed would play an important part in breaking this cycle? And can we deliver services running from routine supervision in the community to the lifelong risk management of others that honours the values that Lord Gill introduced yesterday, that SASO represents, the values that we think of being distinctive to our approach in Scotland, those of welfare, care and compassion? Now, sadly, my deliberations in preparing for this conference were interrupted by the news, first of the serious illness and then the death of a man who has really been an extraordinary influence in my life and that of countless others. So in delivering this presentation, I want to reflect on and consider the relevance of, to our questions, the work of Don Andrews, who spent his long and influential working life saying, "Do you know what? You can." Don was, on the one hand, the mighty and fearless evangelist of evidence-based practice in our field. He's the co-author of several risk needs instruments, co-author of 5 editions of The Psychology of Criminal Conduct. He was latterly Professor Emeritus and Distinguished Research Professor at Carleton University in Ottawa. He's no less than a household name in this field and a force to be reckoned with by anyone who denied the evidence or dared to do it within his hearing or within his presence. On the other hand, he was also a delightful man, a guide to many, a mentor, a humble and gracious person too, but with an entirely mischievous sense of humour. He would be probably quite horrified if during this talk, as I probably will do, I refer to what Don told us, because he would strongly protest and humbly protest that he did nothing on his own and that everything he did was dependent on the collaboration of others, and his list of those others would be many, but they would undoubtedly notably include Jim Bonta, Steve Wormuth and Paul Gendreau. And it's that balance of utter conviction, tireless passion, grace and devilment that made Don the man he was. Now, he's left us with his work and his wisdom and an often repeated challenge to deliver humane, ethical, just and effective human services if you want to reduce reoffending. To our questions that are posed to us today and throughout this conference, he would respond, "Yes, you can, if you choose to, and if you follow the evidence." So the question is not only can we, but will we? And this is what I want to focus on today. I want to look through some of Don's work and see the relevance to some of the questions that we have posed here today. Now, at the outset, I would say I am no academic, I am no researcher, and I'm no expert. What you're going to get here today is the ramblings of a rather nostalgic old social worker, and I'm afraid that's what you're getting. So what did Don teach us? A summary version that's very fully documented in this 5th edition of the well-known book that I think is pretty much a staple textbook for any working in this field. Don told us that from the 1970s, people who demonstrate certain positive qualities and values have a more positive impact on their clients. From the 1990s, he was moving on to tell us that interventions that accord to certain principles have a demonstrably greater effect on reoffending rates. And then from the early 2000s, organisations that train, select, support staff with those qualities to deliver interventions that accord to those principles are more effective still. Latterly, Don and his colleagues were moving on to question What if a criminal justice system itself adopts those questions? Now, regrettably, Don has now left us and his colleagues to go on and consider that question. Now, Don began, as many of you will know, began his career at a time when this kind of optimism was very much needed. I wonder how different our view of the world would be, of our world would be, if a small group of psychologists and researchers at Carleton University in Ottawa and some of their pals around the world had not committed themselves to countering the negativity and pessimism that was around in the 70s. Now, that pessimism was to a certain extent personified by a man called Robert Martinson, perhaps unfairly, but he was a leading protagonist of, as we now well know, the Nothing Works movement. He wrapped up rehabilitation at that time as largely pageantry, rumination, and rubbish. And how influential that Nothing Works dogma was. It was almost unquestioningly embraced by the media, many criminologists, the political left and the political right. Grabbed wholeheartedly by the political right, it was used to justify tougher and more punitive criminal justice policy in the USA and parts of the UK. Ironically, it was just the opposite of the impact that Martinson had been looking for. He was actually a lifelong liberal and campaigner for reform. And what he had believed was that his exposure of the illusion of rehabilitation would end the excessive detainment of individuals in the name of treatment. And a year before his tragic death, Martinson conceded that he'd been wrong. Some things did work, but by that time, there were very few prepared to listen, other than that very important few who continued to work to evidence what Martinson ultimately conceded. Some things do work and some things don't. Now, interestingly, while other areas of the world fully embraced, or not fully, but welcomed and embraced this Nothing Works agenda to some extent, it had a much lesser impact in Scotland. Because in the late 60s, the course of criminal justice in Scotland was being influenced by the ethos of Kilbrandon. Scotland embraced a progressive, rehabilitative and restorative approach, just as the rest of the world pronounced it passé. It created a new profession to deliver this approach, social work, and as a profession that from the outside was guided by the Kilbrandon ethos, if for a long time, little else. And I know this for sure because I was one of its early recruits. And I landed in new social work land in the late 1970s, knowing very much what I wanted to do and why, but just without a scooby about how to do it. Excuse me if I keep stopping for water. Now, I'll not be the only one in the room. In fact, I know I'm not the only one in the room who plodded through those intervening years and then was abruptly awakened in the mid-1990s by the revolution that was the What Works movement. My own epiphany happened at a What Works conference in 1995, at which again and again speakers presented on the collective findings of a group of international researchers and laid out for us the basic roadmap of what works. Was that boring that they all told us the same thing? No, it wasn't. We'd be sitting here today listening to them if we'd had the chance. It was awesome. People were rapt with wonder at this news that there was guidance to tell us what we could do that would make us more effective. The messages, that I'll paraphrase them, we were taught, if you prioritise intensive interventions for those who actually need them, that's a good start. If you focus on the issues that underpin their offending, that's better still. Now, actually, I've just an irreverent comment at this moment. I had made a vow that I wouldn't say criminogenic needs during this, but now I hear there's a word called agentic. I think I might actually go back to criminogenic as well. So, and use approaches that are known to work, that tackle those issues and deliver them in a way that engages and motivates the individual you're working with. Don't rely on one approach. Increase your chances by adopting various methods. Use the influence of the community and harness positive influences. And then, very importantly, do what you plan to do, do it well, follow the roadmap carefully, and make it work. Always the last on the list was integrity. That's why I've bolded it and put it in italics. I'm not in any way de-emphasizing the importance of the multimodal approach of the community. But integrity was always the last one in the list. But as we're going to discuss, it's actually the key to how well it works. The list has been expanded over time, but it's summarized and now well known as the RNR model. Naturally, the model has evolved since 1995 with ever-growing evidence, but the essential core of it remains unchanged. Now, can it be improved further? There's no doubt that it can be. As evidence emerges, it will change. There are other current models of interest, and particularly in Scotland, the resistance paradigm, and to some extent the Good Lives model. They bring a richness of values and a focus on engagement and motivation that I think is complementary as opposed to an alternative. Arguments to focus, particularly by practitioners, on strengths and resilience in addition to risk have been heeded in the model. However, as Ogliff and Davis argue, they should all supplement the evidence base, build on what is known to work until such times as we have evidence to support an entirely different model. But even then, I do ask myself why any alternative model would not want to intervene as much as needed, but not anymore. Focus on the areas of problems, issues, or needs that need to be identified, and use methods that are known to work. What sets the RNR model apart from others is the evidence that's been gathered to demonstrate that it works. This evidence has gained it the enthusiastic acclaim of many and the reluctant acknowledgement of others. As the premier model of offender rehabilitation in the world today. But as always, there's a sting in the tail because it sometimes works better than others. It isn't easy. The principles sound common sense, and I think they probably are common sense, but their application requires commitment at all levels. It's not a roadmap that's handed out to frontline practitioners and leave them to get on with it. It needs to be followed at all levels of the organisation. Now, as I said at the outset, I'm no researcher. And this is my only concession to statistics or figures. And what I'll tell you here, the bigger the number, the better. And that's about what it comes down to. Here, Don and Jim have demonstrate what they have on many occasions. That the more the RNR principles that are adhered to, so in the bottom we've got 0, 1, 2, or 3. So 0 is they didn't think about the risk, need, or responsivity principle. At 3, they attended to all of them. So the level of intervention, the focus of the intervention, and the method of intervention were all adhered to. What we have down the left-hand column is the percentage point difference between the study groups and the control group, the difference in the reoffending rates, the mean effect size, as Dawn would call it. Now, we've got two different colours of columns, and this is where the sting in the tail comes. In the light blue column, we've got what we might call model studies. In the darker blue, we've got what happens in the real world. Now, by model studies, Dawn would be thinking of what we might think of pilot studies. where you've got a small group of well-prepared, well-selected staff overseen by somebody who designed the method, evaluated, quality assured throughout, with a pretty small group. Now, what we see that with that kind of, in that kind of situation, we can look at percentage point reductions of about 34% compared to 15 in the real world. But 15% is not to be sniffed at either. And of course, within this, there'll be real world initiatives that far exceeded that. And what we also know within there are some real disappointments. There's evidence of large scale rollouts of what Dawn describes as star programs that resulted in failure. Examination of those failures tells us quite a lot. In the USA and in the UK, well-known respected programs such as multisystemic therapy, aggression replacement therapy, reasoning and rehabilitation have shown poor results when introduced in large scales. And some of the failures involve, first of all, some basics, lack of attention to risk needs assessment, case management practices, staff who are either poorly trained or poorly supported, and sometimes downright disaffected. Implementations in the midst of organisational upheaval, and lack of attention to quality assurance or implementation issues. In addition, there have been concerns raised about, and we've heard it already today, about mechanistic, managerial or bureaucratic approaches. And there is evidence of that. But let's not repeat Martinson's mistake. The misguided and unethical application of a sound approach reflects on the application of it rather than the approach. But I think there maybe is a distinction that we need to learn in terms of implementations, that there is a difference between rolling out an initiative and implementing it with integrity. So it can be done, it won't be easy, and it won't be quick. And this is where we're faced with a choice about whether or not it's worth it. Now, as with any choice, our own beliefs, our attitudes and previous experiences will influence the choices that we make. If we believe that we are alone, with no support, the choice may seem too difficult. We may blame others, we may feel entirely overpowered, in which cases we may just reject the choice to change altogether. Or we may just make out that we're complying. There's a question of belief involved, which involves deciding, is it worth it? Can I do it? Have I ever succeeded before? What have I got going for me? And who's going to support me when I try to make this big change? It's a long journey from A to B for an individual to move from persistent offending to desistance. We're on our own long journey in Scotland just now. We are trying to move from A to B because the Prisons Commission gave us a choice. Now, the Reducing Reoffending Programme is the concerted, ambitious and collaborative response by the Scottish Government to the recommendations of the Prisons Commission. What might Dawn's comment on this programme be? Now, remember, Dawn never minced his words. He would say, it is good that you are so clear about your aim. It's great that you aspire to effective disposals, but you will need to follow the evidence if you want to achieve it. Reorganisation of sentences may be needed, but do not expect the rebranding or reshaping of existing sentences to make the difference. The only thing that will make the difference is the quality and integrity of the services you deliver within those sanctions, whatever they're called. He probably would acknowledge that we've made a start. nudge poll, that we've made a good start. We've just reached the end of the first phase of a long-term project to introduce the level of service case management inventory as a common means of risk needs assessment in criminal justice social work in the community and in the prison service. A national training programme has just begun and will be completed by the end of next year. One aim of this project, and an important one, is to ensure that every offender under supervision has a case management plan that relates directly to a risk needs assessment. Now, let's be very clear that that's what the LSCMI is for. To structure assessment and case planning in line with the principles of RNR. It's not for the purpose of categorising or labelling individuals. The authors are explicit that it is not there to determine a sanction, but to guide the interpretation of that sanction once it's been imposed. So this is a good start, but despite the years of the blood, sweat, toil and tears it's taken us to get to this point, it is only the start. It's only the start because we have to make the right choice, because we have a choice of whether to roll it out or implement it with integrity. We have a close neighbour in Jersey that we could learn from in this respect, a much smaller jurisdiction than Scotland. But in 1996, Jersey Probation Service started by introducing LSIR, the previous version of LSCMI, and then introduced a few programmes. Throughout that time, Peter Rayner, on behalf of the University of Swansea, has been closely involved with Jersey. They're now moving on to a stage where they're investigating the skills that are required in one-to-one supervision of offenders. So after those 15 years, or whatever that is, 14 years, Jersey can demonstrate the impact of different disposals, of different interventions. They can demonstrate changes in the risk needs scores of individuals after interventions. But what strikes me as important is, can you imagine what it's like being a practitioner in Jersey, having continual attention paid to your practice, getting routine feedback about how you're doing, about whether it's working or not? This is implementation rather than rolling out. But anyway, where do we go next? Having developed a case management plan, the next step is to carry it out. It's the task of case management, working with an individual to promote change, delivering good supervision sessions, engaging and motivating, providing the right services and interventions, that the effectiveness of community disposals lies. The Prisons Commission recognised the centrality of this task and urged that it be given priority. They therefore also recognised the centrality of criminal justice social work in this objective. So how does this, recalling the positioning of the management of offenders in the community in social work, how does this position us when we question, can we deliver services in the community that promote desistance, rehabilitation and reintegration, interventions that reduce reoffending? Back to this book again. Each of the editors, oh no, one before that, Paul. Thanks. Each of the editors of this book has at one point or other identified advantages and importance of locating this responsibility within social work. Now, we start with the advantage of having an agency and professional group who embrace responsibility to deliver human services of care, inclusion and empowerment, alongside responsibility to reduce reoffending. A fundamental social work value is belief in the potential for change. And this is hugely important. Dawn would agree that this ticks two or three boxes and overcomes fundamental difficulties that have occurred in other jurisdictions. In the psychology of criminal conduct that I was referring to earlier, Dawn and Jim Bonta highlighted about seven of the big challenges that face us when we try to implement evidence-based practices. And the first three of them are pretty much attended to by the fact that they're in the community and within prison-based social work, that it's located within social work. From the late 1970s, Dawn Andrews began to identify characteristics and practices that distinguish the more effective practitioner. Now, in 1990, he described them thus. No, can we go back to Paul? Thanks. He describes qualities of tolerance, flexibility, sensitivity, and interpersonal style, and engaging an individual in shifting the balance of course and rewards. We don't have research at the moment to give us the fine detail of what goes on, what takes place in community supervision in Scotland. And in that regard, we have much in common with the rest of the world. However, the attitudes and qualities that Dawn described there are central to the social work value base and will be found in social work literature and in social work curricula. Now, several studies on, those qualities have been redefined into core correctional practices, it's come to be called. A range of approaches, skills, and techniques that have been identified as leading to better outcomes. Consistent with what would be Dawn's advice, the Scottish Accreditation Panel would expect that programmes were designed and delivered in accordance with those practices. 20 years on, Dawn and Jim had been reflecting in the 2010 edition about those qualities that he identified way back in the 80s and saying, actually, we wouldn't change a word of it. I don't know if that is pig-headed, or is it conviction, or is it resilience? But are those skills and qualities and techniques routinely applied in community supervision as well as in programmes? Many will be often, but unlike a programme, there's not a manual for community supervision. New research is emerging that has the potential to be of great importance here. Jim Bonta, Dawn's long life colleague, was intrigued by the unknown of community supervision, but like the Prisons Commission, convinced of its importance of case management. Jim Bonta and some colleagues went about trying to explore the effectiveness of community supervision and didn't find many studies to refer to, but found that it produced a very small positive effect of 2% when they looked at the various studies that there were. Could be worse, but it could be better. They also went and looked in one Canadian province very closely at practice and found a resounding lack of the skills and practices that would be expected to produce the better outcomes. So they went about developing a three-day training package. The overall project's called the Strategic Training Initiative in Community Supervision. They trained officers in three provinces to deliver structured supervision sessions using cognitive behavioural skills and techniques to clients with medium to high risk need levels, and gave those practitioners monthly practice supervision. Now, after a two-year follow-up, there was a difference of 15 to 18 percentage points in reoffending rates. Is there something here that might be useful to us to learn about? I actually think that there is potential in this research to be the next thing in the What Works movement. I think if we look at that and take on what that research is telling us, I think the messages that also we were taking from Dawn is that we probably are quite a few steps towards it. And maybe we just have to look a bit closely at community supervision to see if we can develop it, even to the extent of understanding it better in the first instance. I'm sure I'm not the only one here who feels a bit sad that we are saying farewell to probation after such a long history. Now, there's plenty of literature commenting on the history and development of probation, just not much on its effectiveness. But I think we should be grateful to recent works by Fergus McNeill that give us a rich and informative account of individuals' experiences of what worked for them and didn't work for them in probation in the past, so that we do have a record, a document of that long history. Nevertheless, as we move forward with a new community payback order, it'd be wonderful if we could gather the kind of data and undertake the kind of research to let us know its impact on reoffending, so that we can also give feedback to practitioners on their practice. Is it working or is it not? Now, in Scotland, we like to believe that we have our own approach, something that makes us distinctive from other jurisdictions. And again, that was mentioned first thing yesterday. A book has just been published that I refer to here that explores this belief, its value and its values, and again identifies this location of supervision in the realm of social work as one aspect of that distinctiveness. But the authors go on to suggest some threats to this, however, through what they call convergence with other jurisdictions. And they may be referring there, or they do refer there, to examples of MAPA, even indeed the Community Payback Order, and other more historic incidences of where we have converged. And what they want to urge us to do is to maintain our distinctiveness. I think, as we say goodbye to probation, it's important with the community payback order that we do retain the aspects of probation that are distinctive and worthy of retention. The authors of this book raise some interesting points, and they reiterate the view that attention to risk has led to examples of mechanistic and more punitive policy and practice. I want to question slightly their suggestion that Scotland's approach to risk management is one of them. In the late 1990s, many jurisdictions around the world were considering how to deal with those they considered to be the most dangerous offenders in their societies. In 2000, an expert committee chaired by Lord Maclean recommended an approach for Scotland that involved a new sentence, the order for lifelong restriction, an extraordinary sentence for the extraordinary offender whose pattern of behaviour suggests that he or she will require concerted lifelong efforts to manage the risk of life-endangering offending posed. However, perhaps setting it apart, the committee set itself the challenge of protecting others from such behaviour while respecting human rights. Central to such a rights-based approach would be the need to find a means to ensure that such a level of restriction would only be applied when warranted by the risk in the first instance, and then subsequently good efforts would be made to reduce that risk to enable the reduction of the restriction and ultimately allow the person a return to the community. This approach would have had no validity or integrity at all unless it was realistic to believe that we can assess and manage risk, while acknowledging the uncertainty, the limitations of risk assessment, the inconsistencies in practice. The committee recommended that standard of practice be set to ensure that all decisions in relation to the OLR were based at all times on the best available evidence and the best possible practice. At the outset, it was estimated that the OLR would largely replace the discretionary life sentence and so lead to approximately 15 OLRs in a year. The OLR became available to the High Court in June 2006. By June 2010, there were 50 odds, and on Friday, there was 59. So this gives us a broad, early, but quite positive indication about the early targeting of the order. But we can't be complacent, because the stakes are far too high. The onerously restrictive nature of this order, which has no review mechanism, it is a lifelong restriction, requires that its use is justified by the risk posed to the public, and that this risk, while it may be reduced, is likely to endure for the remainder of the person's life. The demands that this places on those undertaking risk assessments is also onerous. This is so in all cases, but becomes a greater concern still in the case of young people. Neither the committee nor the policy writers anticipated that this order would be considered for young people. However, it has been. 20% of the cases considered for and made subject to an OLR have been 21 years of age or under. Close monitoring of this is necessary, and one aspect of this monitoring is quality assurance of the risk assessment reports. The criteria and competencies that such assessors must meet are exacting, and the accreditation process for them is rigorous. And this must and will remain so. Furthermore, once an individual is made subject to an OLR, they will also be subject to a risk management plan that must be approved for its appropriateness against other published practice standards. And evidence must be given each year as to the integrity of its implementation. A recent international review of indeterminate sentences in this book identified the Scottish approach as a model for other jurisdictions due to those distinctive features. In a forthcoming publication by the same editors of in the next book, the risk management approach is identified by several international experts as the alternative to excessive detention in the name of public protection. So I want to suggest, if not argue, that this is not a convergence with more punitive approaches. What we've developed in Scotland is a proportionate and rights-conscious approach that uses the concept of risk constructively as a means to promote and not undermine human rights. But in the wider field too, risk assessment must provide a defensible base for decisions that inform restrictions of liberty, to identify least restrictive measures necessary to protect others. Rights-based considerations are as relevant in the wider field. So, I mean, an example that we might think of here, use of intensive supervision packages must be based on a risk management plan, in my view, that evidences the need for such measures, evidences how such a degree of restriction will address the elements of the risk, and has a realistic exit plan from such restrictive and resource-intensive measures. How else could we defend such measures as anything other than prison in the community? However, managing risk in the community and preparing prisoners for release is, of course, very, very challenging. And we've already heard today about the challenges that are raised. Even more so than in routine case management, practitioners need guidance and a practice framework to support them. It's now recognised that standards and guidelines are needed for risk practice in the wider field. So there is a far-reaching initiative underway to develop and adopt a common interagency framework for risk practice that's based on standards. We believe that we can do this, that we can adopt and aspire to practice standards that are consistent across agencies, roles and tasks, but are applied appropriately and proportionately. We believe that we can do this if we're guided by the principles of proportionality, evidence-based practice, and collaboration. We've already mentioned proportionality and evidence-based practice, but collaboration needs some particular mention. Like the reoffending programme itself, this initiative is currently supported by commitment and active participation from all the agencies, and this is essential. An element of hope and optimism in the Reducing Reoffending Programme is the way that it has engaged all the agencies. And perhaps while we looked at the re-emergence of rehabilitation in England and Wales, we never actually really lost that belief in rehabilitation in Scotland. And I think that's one of the reasons that the programme has engaged all the agencies to actively work together. And this is essential, and not only in the short term. For we must be very, very wary of the temptation to look for quick fixes or quick wins. Implementing evidence-based practices of any sort takes time. So, can we do it? I think we can, if. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Yvonne, for that wonderful review of where we are in Scotland and what the prospects are. Now, we've got a period of about 20 minutes, 25 minutes before lunch, when I'm going to invite the three speakers that you've heard this morning to come up and take their a seat at the table, thank you very much, and then the lights will go up so you can all see them, and they are open to questions on what's been a very fascinating review of where we are in England, where we are in Scotland, and where we are in terms of the prospects of risk assessment and prediction. So if I could ask you to address your questions to any particular member of the panel, and they can join in as they feel they want to contribute to each question that comes. There are two roving microphones, so put your hand up. One's at the back there and the other somewhere else over there. Put your hand up and say who you are when you ask your question. So thank you very much. Any questions? I'll start you off then. I'd be interested in the panel's view on whether, this is particularly in the light of Professor Kemsall's talk, whether Scotland runs the risk of this sort of inflation of the indeterminate sentence, which has happened in England, or whether there are protective factors.
Possibly. I did make it clear at the beginning that the two systems are not the same. Mm-hmm. And I think there are important dissimilarities. Firstly, it looks to me that there is greater quality assurance and regulation, both of risk assessment reports and then of not so much the sentencing that leads to, because I think the regulation of the reports is important. The evidence base and the assessment of risk that sentences are basing those decisions on, I think, looks more robust and rigorous. That would be my view from the outside. So I think that's the first important distinction. The second important distinction is actually then how those OLRs go on to be managed through the system. And again, a robust system of quality assuring risk management plans and their implementation, I think, is really important. So there's a sense of people actually having a sentence journey and, importantly, a programme and treatment journey, which I think, again, is important. So Yvonne gave the figures, and I thought actually the figures were quite reassuring. I don't see a runaway Scottish OLR train in quite the same way. Just on a note of similarity that it might be important that we think about, is actually how big is the group of people who are designated as unmotivated, untreatable, unprogrammable. And I think that group is important because that's the group that are likely to exceed their tariff term by a very long way. And are we right to accept those labels? And what do we do with that group? And I think that's important.
Thank you very much. Now, other questions? Chief Constable Strand.
Thanks very much. David Strang from Lothian and Borders Police. A question really for Professor Cook. I spent the first two decades of my life in Bear's Den, but was fortunate not to suffer from depression.
very fortunate.
I find your presentation very interesting and the numbers persuasive, but I suppose I wanted to ask you what the conclusion from your work is. I mean, in terms of predictive, it looked like what we have at the moment helps us to predict that the risk of reoffending might be somewhere between 0% and 100%. Are you suggesting that the murky past was better than what we have now? What's your proposal for the future?
Thank you for that question. No, I'm not proposing, let me be very clear, I'm not proposing the murky past was a better approach. And I think if we return to the McLean Committee, we deliberated on this issue to a great extent, and we adopted and proposed that the approach should be what we call structured clinical or structured professional judgment. And there is a whole technology there which is designed to help you manage people who may be deemed to be risky. And in fact, that's the basis of the assessments for the order of lifelong restriction. They use this approach. And I didn't have time to discuss it, but essentially you identify the risk factors in the individual, but you focus on risk factors which are known from the research literature and from practice to be relevant to future risk. So it's evidence-based in that sense. You then do an individualized assessment of the risk factors and their relevance for future risk in the individual. So it is something that requires a degree of skill. It's what we would, in the jargon, psychological jargon, we'd call risk formulation. And where you try and, so for example, we know that in Scotland particularly, we know that alcohol is a risk factor for violence. But there are many different ways in which it may be a risk factor for violence. For example, it may be it disinhibits people. It may be because someone has a mental illness and it exacerbates that mental illness. It may be relevant because this individual is seeking out drugs of some sort and has to go into a subculture where violence is more normal. So you have to work out why the risk factor is relevant in the particular case. And from that flows the risk management plan, where you would be thinking in terms of, do they need a particular form of treatment? Do they need a particular type of monitoring? Do they need a particular type of supervision? Are there identifiable victims? Can you put in place victim safety planning? And of course, now we would talk about the Good Lives model, where you try and give individuals better opportunities to gain the things they wish in pro-social ways. So the idea is to replace statistics with thinking. You go back to try and analyze what is happening. And that is clearly a high level skill and can only be applied, you know, currently there are not many people who have that skill, but it's a matter of developing systems early on where you can triage people into groups, those who don't actually need any sophisticated analysis and those who do. And I think that's one of the major challenges we have, is developing systematic triage systems which are not based on these simplistic linear models as we see in the case of the actuaries I was discussing. So that's a long answer.
To follow on what David's saying and to reflect on David's question as well. picking up from what David's saying about the structured professional judgment approach, the triage approach, and the different steps that are involved in risk assessment, from identifying factors, analysing their relevance to an individual, and then going on and evaluating what that means to the task in hand, is precisely where the approach that David's talking about and the standards that were set for the OLR, we are transferring proportionately into the approach that's being adopted in Scotland, in the frame approach that I didn't go on to at the end but started to allude to. And I think there's a challenge in the structured professional judgment approach to realise that when we're managing offenders in the community or in MAPA and in the prisons, there's a number of different professionals involved. So we have got to interpret structured professional judgment for the profession who are making or undertaking the assessment. So for police officers and social workers, it's a different kind of structured professional judgment because it's a different task that they're undertaking and it's different qualifications, experiences and skills that they have. So the kind of challenge that we're facing in this group, and we wouldn't mind some help, David, if you've got any time to spare, would be to how do we make a structured professional judgment approach suitable for each of the different professions?
I'm Nancy Laux from Families Outside. I was interested to hear this morning and throughout the conference, really, the emphasis on risk assessment and management is very much focused on the individual being assessed, which is understandable. David's talk this morning alluded to the importance of context, and Yvonne, just now you were mentioning the role of the professionals in making these assessments. Obviously, at Families Outside, we're very keen to involve the families to a greater extent, not only because they'll often have a lifetime of experience with the individual being assessed, but as such they'll have a very wide knowledge and experience of the risks and the triggers and the needs and so on. And I was really just interested for the whole panel to ask whether there was much evidence or experience of involving families in this and whether it's worthwhile, whether it actually contributes to the overall picture.
I think it's absolutely essential, Nancy. I mean, I think for any risk assessment, any form of assessment, the information that's gathered has to be from a variety of sources. And I think not to refer to the family it would be an omission. I don't know if I can say much more than that. I think it's absolutely essential that information is drawn from a variety of sources, that the family is understood to the extent to which it can contribute to supporting the individual in not offending again or not, or to what extent, in fact, the family may be vulnerable. I mean, I think assessment of the family situation is absolutely essential.
I'm only aware of two sort of direct bits of evidence. The first is from the mental health arena, where a number of inquiries, I think it was David Shepherd who looked at 25 years of inquiries for the Zito Trust, actually showed that in a number of those cases, family members tried to report that people were deteriorating, becoming unwell or getting more risky. And actually, because they were deemed to be non-professional, their accounts were actually discounted. So that's the first thing. But actually, they're up close and personal and they do know best. And the second piece of work is quite an interesting one by Amanda Robinson at Cardiff, where she looked at victims of domestic violence. And actually, these people, and they were largely women, were the best predictors of more serious violence to themselves, and in many cases were the best predictors of their own homicide, very sadly. And a number of the predictors that those women came forward with were actually then incorporated into the police DASH risk assessment tool. And again, have, so far as was able to tell from looking at what went on to happen, did have a great deal of predictive utility. So in those two important instances, we know it's important and we know it works.
Thank you. David, you want to add
anything? I think there's a major gap in the research and in the practice in relation to understanding what we might call situational factors. And again, I blame the psychologists, because as psychologists, we tend to focus on individuals. We tend to focus on, do they have mental illness? Are they impulsive? Do they have relationship problems and so forth? But that's only one side of the risk equation. risk happens in a context, and we have not moved forward in developing systems for assessing risky situations, and I think there's a major gap there. We've done some work in regard to this in the prisons, where we've developed a tool called PRISM, which is designed to evaluate how the structure of an organisation enhances the probability of violence or diminishes it. And so we can look at things like staff factors, policies and procedures, structural things which are known from the literature to influence the level of violence. But that's a very specific tool for prisons and for forensic hospitals. I think we need a lot more work in that area to see how other contextual factors influence risk. At a practical level, when we're managing risk, we would consider and take into account family factors, but it's done very much in a sort of clinical, professional way rather than it being particularly evidence-based.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just to follow up just quickly, just to emphasize that what we're working towards is something that risk assessment and management are something that families are involved in rather than having it done to them, if that makes sense. And certainly the Scottish Prison Service has made great strides in that in terms of family involvement in integrated case management, for example.
Yes.
But we're looking at things like involvement in MAPA as another example. So thank you very much for that.
Any other questions?
Michelle Berman, University of Glasgow. Thank you for three great papers this morning. This is a question to all of the members of the panel, but it was sparked by something that Professor Cook said at the beginning of his talk around the three eras. And I just wondered whether you think the entire panel, reading from the past and being mindful of what Professor Kemshall spoke about, the broader political and economic climate, whether we are moving into a fourth era of risk assessment and what that might look like.
Right, who wants to start? David, you produced the eras approach. Do you want to start?
Yeah, I think so. That's a difficult one. I think I'd be interested to know what you feel that the fourth era might be. I think the problem at the moment is that we are, in practice at least, we're staggering between the three eras. I still see clinical judgment, unstructured clinical judgment. I still see simplistic predictions based on actuarial models. I don't see as much risk management approach in reports as I'd like to. I see them in the high-level reports for OLRs and such, but so I think we're still a lot to do in terms of getting the risk management paradigm in place, and I'm intrigued to know what the fourth era might be. If you can predict what that will be, I'd be very interested.
Yes, I said it this morning. I think we're moving into the economics of risk rather than the rhetoric of risk, which means I think the cost and benefits of risk responses themselves will have to be more carefully evaluated. So, and for me, that's good. I think the transparency of that will be important. And I think that that's likely to be more evidence-led than perception-led, because I think a lot of policy and risk responses have been very perception-led rather than evidence-led. And I think if I was thinking about what specific changes that might lead to, I think it's likely to see a greater emphasis on good decision making rather than the use of tools. So it'll be about the skills of making good decisions and exercising discretion not to do things based upon the quality of those decisions. In other words, what you're not going to do, what services you're not going to give away, and who you're not going to pay attention to. And then within that, the overarching response to that, we're likely to see a greater focus on the quality of systems and procedures about the delivery of risk. So greater emphasis on governance and quality assurance of the whole of the risk systems. So quality of individual decisions and then quality of the systems that we produce. Because it's only by good decisions and quality systems that we're actually going to be able to rationalise resources towards risk. And that's what I think the economic driver will increasingly lead to.
Thank you very much. Yvonne, do you want to...
Yes, whether we're right or not, I'd like the agencies that are working together just now on developing the framework approach that I was talking about are clear about what they want the fourth generation to look like for multi-agency practice in Scotland. And that is risk assessment and management, risk assessment practice that is purposeful. And I think that follows on from what Hazel was saying, that it is actually there for a purpose to inform decision-making, whether that's initial decision-making, case management, or risk management, and that we also would like to see it being communicated meaningfully in plain language that can be understood between each and all of the professions and the decision-makers that are involved and every party that's involved in that risk assessment process.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Any other questions? Any others? Sheriff Mackey, yes. Sheriff David Mackey.
David Mackey, I'm the sheriff in Alloa. As we move these days towards greater participation, particularly by sheriffs, in the likes of drug treatment testing orders with review hearings and review hearings in relation to probation orders. I'd be interested to know what our panel think about the role, if any, that sentencing sheriffs and judges might have in managing risk and reintegration after sentence.
No, I would like to start. Yvonne, would you like to start in that one? Yes.
What I'd like to say, I mean, just at the outset, then when I mentioned that Don Andrews was latterly talking about what would happen if criminal justice systems as a whole got involved in embracing the evidence-based practice, and that's precisely the kind of things that he had in mind, that risk assessment or rehabilitation is not just something that's done on one side of the bench, but it's shared, the principles and the approaches and the values are shared by the decision makers as well. So I think perhaps with the reviews, the community payback order reviews, etc., it gives us a chance to look at that more.
Hazel, do you have any English light to cast?
Yes, I mean, the initial response is to say, yes, the involvement in risk management implementation by sentences can only be a good thing. But that has to be counterbalanced, I think, by what we're already seeing, which is court service shrinkage and an increased rationalisation of resource in court services. So you've got a driver for greater involvement for all sorts of reasons, some of which I think are political rather than informed by effective risk management, countered on the other hand by courts already closing in England and Wales and a greater focus on the speed of throughput. So I'm not sure how those two things are actually going to work themselves out.
Mm-hmm. David, do you want to add anything on sentence management?
No, I just see this as part of a broader package of things one can do for risk management. It's potentially very useful.
Thank you. Now, any one last question? Dan Gunn. You've got one here?
A last question about LSCMI. The process, as Yvonne alluded to, has been, shall we say, slow and protracted. Can we take it now, because of this process of tremendous consultation, that there is widespread support for LSCMI and that all the agencies are indeed going to unite and use it enthusiastically and effectively?
Yes. Ask a close question. Yes. Yes, they're all going to use it. Are they going to use it effectively, enthusiastically, and well? That's exactly the question that I was posing when I said, are we going to roll it out or are we going to implement it with an integrity? And that's precisely the point we're at just now of working as we're starting the training and trying to encourage all the agencies involved in the different areas to join in quality assurance mechanisms, to agree to that, to join in an evaluation of at least this first year of the implementation. So I think entirely agree with your question. There are still choices to be made, and I hope we all make the right one. But at the moment, the answer is yes. Everybody's signed up and going to be trained by the end of the year, come hell or high water.
Right, good. Well, can I just thank the three speakers again? I think it would have been difficult to get a more high-powered lineup for this morning for this very important topic, and which we'll be pursuing through the rest of the day as well. And could I thank each of them in turn, Professor Kemsall, Professor Cook, and Yvonne Gailey, for giving us three excellent presentations, which I think informed us all and made us think a lot. So thank you very much. Now it's lunchtime, and could you please be back at 2 o'clock, when Dr. Andrew Fraser will give you a briefing on the afternoon session, which is an interactive session, and I'll leave him to give you the briefing at 2 o'clock. So back here at 2, please. Thank you very much.